A president declares some 800,000 people living in his country should be relocated to some other country. Months later, at least 100,000 of displaced people are left to barely survive in packed camps. What are the root causes of the plight of Myanmar's Rohingya people and what needs to be done? I'm Homa Lezgi and you're watching News Analysis.
Well, we had a wave of ethnic violence over the weekend against members of this very persecuted group called the Rohingya in the Arakan state of Burma.
The United Nations says more than 26,000 people have been displaced in a week of violent attacks by Buddhist extremists against Rohingya Muslims in the western state of Rakhine. Over 100 people, most of them Muslims, have been killed since last week. The UN says over 4,600 houses have also been burned to the ground. A fresh round of communal violence broke out after Buddhist extremists attacked Rohingya Muslims and set fire to their homes in several villages in Rakhine.
We lost houses and the money and the everything.
Satellite imagery shows an entire section of a town burned to the ground by the assailants. Thousands of Rohingyas have already fled their homes and are now living in crammed refugee camps following the deadly unrest back in July. They have a simple demand.
We don't want problems. We want peace. We want to be ethnic Rohingyas.
In July 2012, the government did not include the Rohingya minority group on its list of more than 130 ethnic races, and therefore they are denied Myanmar's citizenship. The Rohingya Muslims are considered as one of the most persecuted minority group in the world. They are deprived of basic rights, including education and freedom of movement. They have suffered decades of systematic discrimination and abuse.
Sometimes dictators single out ethnic or religious minorities in their country for special hatred in order to distract their people from the abuses of their own government. And that's what the Burmese government did for decades. And those chickens are coming home to roost right now.
But surprisingly enough, the Rohingya Muslims are getting no different treatment from Myanmar's new government, which has received kudos from the West for its democratic reforms. Back in July, Myanmar's president said some 800,000 Rohingyas living in Myanmar should be either sent to refugee camps or deported. But where to? They're not even welcome across the border in neighboring Bangladesh. Some are accusing the Myanmarese army and police of turning a blind eye to the Buddhist extremist atrocities against the Rohingya Muslims. They're also accused of launching a systematic ethnic cleansing campaign against the minority group.
The military fires indiscriminately. These people can be just travelers who want to come to our town. They don't investigate.
Up until today, the communal hatred and bloodshed in Myanmar has drawn insignificant response from the international community. Thousands of displaced Rohingya Muslims continue to live in makeshift communities and in dire condition, wondering if there will ever be an end to their nightmare of terror and intimidation.
Well, joining me now live from Pennsylvania is Mr. Lin Din. He's a political analyst and writer. I'd also like to welcome our guest in London, Mr. Chris Bambury, political analyst, and with us live from New York, Maxine De Vera, a New York-based reporter. Thank you very much for being with us, everyone, and again on another edition of News Analysis. My first question to our guest in New York, Maxine De Vera, what are your concerns about the fate of these tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees who are heading to the already packed camps along Myanmar's western coasts right now?
Well, the concerns are tremendous. They are people without a home. They are people without support from any nation, even Bangladesh, from which their heritage stems. Apparently, the Bangladeshi Prime Minister has said that her country is too populated and she has no place to take her own people, refugees. What are the concerns? The concerns are for the health, the safety, the children, the malnourished children who are already appearing in the camp situations, and for peace in the area so that there is a cessation to murder and rampage.
Lyndon, now in Pennsylvania, we know that Human Rights Watch has released satellite imagery of a certain village in Myanmar showing the exact number of houses that have been torched, showing the number of more than 800 buildings we're hearing and floating barges being destroyed, set on fire. What do you think is the Myanmarese government's role in all this? And is it actually helping to stop this violence?
Well, the U.S. and the West, they are remaining silent on this because they have nothing to gain from intervening. For decades, Myanmar, Burma, was ruled by a military junta that was pro-China and anti-West. So now it has a government that is opening up towards the West and moving away from China. So the West is not going to upset this balance, this opening that it has. So of course it's going to remain silent on this issue. It doesn't want to say anything critical of the government, although the government is obviously in the wrong. This Burmese government is obviously in the wrong because these people are native to Burma, native to Myanmar, and yet they're not citizens. You know, they are stateless, they are unprotected, and they are prosecuted against, but the U.S. is not going to put the current Burmese government in a bad light. So that's why it's remaining silent. And you have to be careful, too, about asking for the West to intervene, because whenever the West intervenes, it only does so for its own interests, for its own benefits. It's never doing so for human rights reasons. Well, so whenever it intervenes in a situation, right, it usually makes it much worse.
Right. Well, speaking about the kind of international action that can be taken on this, Chris Bambury, we know, for instance, that for one, a UN humanitarian coordinator visited one of the affected areas alongside the border affairs minister of Myanmar. He himself was the one who gave out the numbers and figures about the number of people displaced. But he's also being criticized for not actually announcing the exact number of the Muslims, in opposition, of course, to the Buddhists as well. And there's been a lot said about how partial or impartial the UN is actually on this Rohingya case. What's your thoughts?
Well, I think you have to contrast the lack of any action over what is happening in Myanmar, both in June when we saw the first outbreak of slaughter and once more with the outpouring of concern for what's happening in Syria and elsewhere across the world. So I think there's been a silence really effectively on this. And I think one of the silences which has to be broken is this is not just simply a sectarian conflict between civilians. Amnesty International has pointed to the role of the security forces in carrying out attacks on this Muslim minority. Eyewitnesses fleeing, people who are fleeing the area, report not just being attacked by Buddhist mobs, but also the police doing nothing and then the security forces opening fire on them. So it's not just a question of one-on-one violence here. The state, the Burmese state, the Burmese military are playing a role in this. And this is at a time when, you know, for instance, the British government, the former colonial power, is rushing to do business with the Burmese administration, rushing to get contracts as it opens up to the West. And I agree with my colleague. I think this, in a sense, explains why the silence. In addition, I think the other reason is the whole Islamophobic agenda, which now dominates inside the West. I mean, you know, these are almost regarded as second-class citizens by the West as well as by the Burmese. And I think there is a big responsibility in Britain because it helped create this situation as a former colonial power. Right. It appeased Burmese national Buddhist nationalism in the interwar years. It helped create the current Burmese state. It brought the Burmese the ancestors, if you like, of the Burmese administration to power. It gave them the control of the state and independence. They have a responsibility for this. As always, the British create divide
and rule.
And
that, of course, Chris, brings us to the issue of the root causes involved, doesn't it? I'll come back to that issue very quickly. But first, again, our guest in New York, Maxine, the question that was previously asked about the UN or any kind of international intervention on this case. We're hearing now of 75,000 people in the camps that are in a very bad condition in the border areas. We're hearing of the numbers increasing. You spoke about that yourself. The UN coordinator himself has described it as a very grave situation. But even before this new wave of attacks, what was done for the case of these refugees? Why are we not seeing the kind of attention that at least the UN should be paying to these refugees?
Indeed, it should. These refugees and this situation stems from laws originally put into place in 1984, which step by step caused the Muslim population to become more and more stateless. It reeks of the Nuremberg laws. It's something that the world has seen before and should have had the responsibility of stopping. The United States did have sanctions in place against the former dictator, but as has Britain and as have most of the Western countries, started to lift those sanctions with the emplacement of the new government since 2010. The belief, I believe, was to encourage a more democratic state and resolution of some of these ethnic problems. The fact that a pipeline that will supply China's western provinces will run through this area may have some input to economic interests as well. Should the UN be doing more? The UN should be ashamed of itself for not helping these people and for not preventing the kind of mass movement and distress that is occurring.
Right. And again, speaking about the 1984 law that Maxim was just referring to there, Lyndon, that law, of course, excludes the Rohingya Muslims as one of the country's ethnicities, and it denies them of their basic civil rights. But what should be done about this right now when we are seeing they are part of the population in Myanmar? No other country, even Bangladesh, from which a lot of them came actually to Myanmar, is willing to accept them back. So what should be done about this law?
Well, first off, the UN should do all that it can right now to alleviate.
Yeah, Maxine, if we could leave that question for Lynn Din, and I'll come back to you. Go ahead, Lynn.
Well, the UN should do all that it can right now to alleviate the human suffering. But the bigger issue is the political situation. How are these people going to be acknowledged and enfranchised as a part of Burmese society, and there is no one willing to fight for them. So if they resort to outside help, say to other Muslims organizations, they will be accused of being terrorists. What we have is we don't have a mechanism, the means to address this situation politically, because the UN is basically only willing to fight for U.S. and Western interests. When it comes to these other groups, it usually side against them. So we don't have the means to address these this issue politically. But at the very least, something should be done to help them on a humanitarian basis at the moment, because it's a very urgent emergency.
Back to Chris now. You referred to the role, Chris, rather previous colonial British rulers and their role in creating Myanmar, or as they call it, Burma, as it is right now. Now, some people have been saying, well, this shows that actually those British colonial rulers are the ones who allowed these migrations from Bangladesh to take place, and that these migrations are illegal, and that whatever happens, something needs to be done about what they call illegal migrations and illegal immigrants now in Myanmar or Burma. So what can be done about these people?
Well, this line about illegal Muslims living in Myanmar is fantasy. I mean, Muslims have been living in this country for hundreds of years, even before British colonialism. But actually, the anti-Muslim stuff was fanned in the 1930s by the demand for Burma for the Burmese. There were attacks on Muslims during that period. Burmese nationalism was formed in a very, very anti-Muslim way, and against other minorities, it has to be said as well. One person we should mention here is the Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Her father actually was the first leader of independent Burma, but was assassinated just actually before independence because he advocated a Burma which included the minorities, which was anathema to the majority of the Burmese nationalists. And one thing that she could do is speak out against this slaughter of the Muslims, because that would carry weight both within Burma, Myanmar, and internationally. But we've yet to hear her speak out. And I think we should be appealing for that. And I don't quite agree with my colleague. I agree with much of what he said, but I don't quite agree. I think Muslim states should be taking action, not just watching this and doing nothing, which seems to be the case. It's not just Bangladesh. It's also, as I said, Saudi Arabia, where some of these people have found refuge in the past, who's now talking about deporting them, deporting them back. You know, some of these 5,000 of these people are being held in detention in Saudi Arabia, as is my understanding. You know, when are we going to see the Muslim states taking action on behalf of the co-religionists? That's a question we should be asking here as well. And I think we should be stepping up the ante here. Rather than just the British and the Americans and the rest running to get contracts in Burma, which is what they're after, a very mineral-rich country, you know, we should be saying, before you sign any contract, before you do any business with the Burmese government, put this question of human rights, religious freedom, an end to discrimination and apartheid, which is what exists here, you know, in terms of it, first on the agenda. No contract, no contact until these killings are stopped, until the discrimination is lifted. And that's a basic demand for equality. Burma has now signed up to the UN Charter of Human Rights. It should be held to adhere to that Charter of Human Rights. And instead, what we're seeing is an action, which I think opposes, right, once again, unfortunately, the hypocrisy of America, Europe, and many of the Western countries over this issue. Mm. But as I say, I think their attitude is, it's just Muslims here, and really they don't count.
Mm. You just mentioned the historical factor about the Muslims and when they lived in Burma or Myanmar, actually. Now, Max, in New York, the thing is, those who are supporting the Myanmarese government are saying that why should the government be unwilling to recognize another ethnic group when it already does recognize 135 ethnic groups? So they're saying that this is actually about a case of illegal immigrants and it should be treated as such. Others like Chris Bambury there saying if we look at history, actually Muslims have been living there for years and centuries and generations.
Well, I think that taking the moral high road, as has been suggested, that contracts be contingent upon solving the citizenship position of this ethnic group would be a marvelous change in general economic and political policy worldwide. The implication would be that there would be a way of gaining citizenship related to business, and that would not be out of the ordinary. That has happened in many countries, where citizens who can contribute some aspect of economic development or business find a way to find citizenship. I think it happens in America all the time when there are desirable people, and certainly people who have skills are desirable. And this ethnic group has to be brought in among the other 130-plus groups and allowed a mechanism to have citizenship. Bangladesh is refusing to call them citizens, to allow them to come to what would be perhaps an ancestral home. There needs to be a way to handle the lives of 800,000 people with some civility.
Right. Lyndon, a lot of people were saying that what is actually happening in Myanmar now and the government's opposition to giving citizenship rights to these people is not a matter actually of ethnicity, but rather a matter of religion. They don't want the Muslims as part of a religious group to be in Myanmar rather than as part of the Rohingya ethnic group. Now, would you agree with that?
Well, many people are disappointed that Aung San Suu Kyi and the National League for Democracy haven't spoken up for these Muslims, but they rely for their support on Buddhists, and mostly the Buddhist monks. The Buddhist monks, they are very powerful in Burma. You know, I'm afraid Aung San Suu Kyi is already thinking like a politician. You know, she might become the next president of Burma, so she's not going to speak up for these Muslims because she must rely on the Buddhist vote, the Buddhist support for her. That's her base. So she's willing to sacrifice these Muslims for her political ambition, I'm afraid. And this dovetails nicely with what the West wants to happen in Burma.
Right. And you say that Aung San Suu Kyi, Chris, she said when she was asked about this case that she does not know whether the Rohingyas should be or shouldn't be or are or not citizens. She's just said she doesn't know about this case. What do you think about her position, how it actually is affecting this, at the same time that we're seeing the president, for instance, saying that his solution would be a relocation of these people to another country? Now, that might sound shocking to some of our viewers, but actually, is that how it actually sounds among the Myanmarese people themselves?
Well, how can she not know?
Human rights
that question to Chris.
Not something that applies, for instance, to her. The support she received, rightly, when she was in house arrest and she was under her party was banned inside Burma. That we can't support that and then turn our back on those people inside Burma who are being minimal, who are being completely discriminated against. And a series of laws going all the way back to 1962, which discriminates against them, denies them education, denies them rights. This is not something you can divide. You can't choose. And the issue here is tied in. I mean, there are real problems in national questions in Burma, for instance, the Karen people on the other side of the country. But the nationalism, Burmese nationalism, is centered on Buddhism, And it's about the exclusion of this minority. And this is what it's about, and about a denial that these people essentially have lived ever in Myanmar. And the creation of a single coherent a Buddhist state, which has been central to the administration. And I think you also have to say, my suspicion is the former military are casting around to try and rebuild a base in the society, having suffered an electoral reverse by using sectarianism as a way of doing that. And they've put Aung San Suu Kyi on my back foot. I agree with my colleague. I think it's tragic that she's not coming out and saying things about this. But as usual, we see people who've come out of jail, come out of detention, people have campaigned for them. And in order to further her political ambition and her political career, she seems not to be choosing not to speak out in some of the most oppressed people in the world. And I think if she fails to speak out, it's shame on her.
Right. In New York, Maxine, we're hearing some people saying that what's happening in Rakhine State is Buddhist extremists trying to create some kind of separation between the Muslims who live there and the Buddhists who live there. And this is about an initial step toward a major ethnic cleansing. Now, do you think that this is something that at least implicitly the government is supporting to in some other way force all of the Muslims out of the country, or in some or other way actually create this separation?
Well, this is a classic example of creating an enemy without in order to stem the problems of the government itself. For a Nobel Prize winner to say she, quote, just doesn't know is shameful. If she doesn't know, then let her get learned and understand what's happening to these people who are her co-countrymen, if not her co-citizens at this point. There have been instances in history where entire populations were airlifted to countries that were willing to receive them. I think one can look at the history of the Yemenite Jewish population and its very, very successful relocation. Should there be a true and continuing undertaking to destroy this population, then it comes to the responsibility of so many of the world countries to create a haven. There needs to be a unified response from member states of the United Nations, from co-religionists, from humans to save these people's lives and their future.
Right. And Lyndon, would you say that is a workable and applicable solution? What kind of a solution is needed here that could be lasting? Do you think that the important issue here is to give them the citizenship or to somehow or other take them out of the country and give them a haven?
Well, it would be appalling if
Lyndon, if you could respond to that. Lynn.
Yeah. Yes, there's no reason why they should be relocated because they belong there. You know, this situation is so similar to the Palestinians in Palestine, a people who, you know, has every right to be exactly where they are and yet are stateless and deprived and persecuted. So, you know, they should not go anywhere. But, you know, like I said, there's no mechanism to solve this problem politically.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid we've run out of time. A lot of questions remaining there. Big thank you to Lyndon, political analyst and writer joining us from Pennsylvania, Chris Bambury, political analyst in London, and Maxine De Vera, New York-based reporter. Thank you very much for being on another edition of News Analysis. From me, Homa Lesgi, and the rest of the team, it's goodbye.